Robert Storr is a curator, an art critic, and a painter. He's also dean of the Yale School of Art. Let's take a look back at a conversation we had with him before he visited Wisconsin. Robert Storr, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Well, as a museum audience person who doesn't really know what's going on behind the scenes, I'm excited to talk to you about this. One thing I've noticed over the years in museums is kind of two different approaches to displaying art. Some places, it's almost a history lesson, lots of context, educational material, maybe even a recorded something. And then others, it's almost as though there's artist and title, and that's it, and it leaves it all to my interpretation. Is that a back and forth in the art world?
It's a back and forth, and it's a back and forth in the work of a given curator. I've done shows with no labels whatsoever, although I always give handouts that people can read at their discretion. And I've done shows that have been heavily posted with information. It depends upon the art. It depends upon the audience.
And what makes that decision? What kind of art, what kind of audience would you put more material out there for?
Well, for starters, with audience, if you can't assume that they know a good deal already, it's not really very democratic to just throw them into the deep end of the pool. On the other hand, you never want to talk down to the audience, no matter what you're dealing with. So, for example, if you were showing religious art of the 16th century, nowadays it might be necessary to explain the Bible stories that are in the pictures, whereas once upon a time people pretty much knew them. If you're looking at art that has an origin in some important chapter of modern art history and people don't know it, then you do them a service by telling them. But going to a museum is not going to a classroom, and an exhibition should not be a book on the wall.
And you've done a lot of work with the works of living artists. Is there ever a tension between putting up that information and the artist saying, no, that's not quite right?
Well, first of all, artists don't necessarily have the definitive answer either. Mm. So you listen to artists, but you don't. I've never done an exhibition where the artist told me what to do, nor ever accepted that an artist edit my catalog text. Mm. If they want to work with me, then they have to accept that I will interpret things in ways that they might think otherwise. On the other hand, I'm sensitive to what they think, and I do a lot of asking and interviewing before I go forward.
I've seen you quoted as saying something along the lines of, you're trying to create a forum where art and ideas can meet in an exhibit. How do you do that?
And where the public can meet itself, because, of course, members of the public differ, and they will see things differently. And you want them to understand that, number one, there is no right answer. Number two, the differences among them in interpretation, in emotional response, in pleasure, are important and part of the work of art itself. And therefore, you want to stimulate dialogue among them, as well as between them and the work, them and the museum, them and the artist.
I think sometimes there's a perception from, I guess, the ordinary man or woman on the street that there's this art world out there that doesn't have much to do with our everyday life. Is that true? And is that necessarily a bad thing?
Well, there are parts of it that don't have much to do with their everyday life, even mine, which is pretty much committed to art. But I think the idea of a super elitist art world that looks down on the public is actually mistaken. And I think the idea that artists are trying to hoodwink the public is, in most cases, also mistaken. Making art is just too hard. And for most people, it's something that they don't get paid much for. There are huge prices for some things and very little reward for others. So the first thing you should sort of grant for the sake of better understanding is that maybe this crazy thing you're looking at was not done by a crazy person and was not done in order to get your goat. It was done because they had an insight that you have not yet had, and you're welcome to it if you wish.
I wonder about understanding the biography of the artist. Sometimes at talking to authors and you ask, oh, did this personal experience inform your writing? And very often the answer is no, not at all. Do we understand an artist better if we know their story as a person and as an artist?
In some instances, yes. In others, no. In some cases, for example, Louise Bourgeois, with whom I worked for 30 years very closely, began talking about early childhood experience in her life a couple of years before she became truly famous. And those stories ended up being the sort of the prism through which people see her art. And that's been a problem for her because people haven't given her enough credit for the intelligence and the sort of synthetic imagination, and they sort of ascribe it to this acting out of trauma to a fault, right? And the same thing happened with Jackson Pollock. The reason Jackson Pollock made all those paintings was not because he drank hard or because he had a conflicted identity. It's because he was thinking about painting in a very specific way. So biography can be useful. It can also actually get in the way in a major fashion.
You've done exhibits in a lot of different places, and I want to talk about a couple of them. One, in Venice, you were, as I understand, the first American to curate the big Biennale. Forgive
right.
my Italian.
That's right.
Back in 2007, I think.
That's correct. Yeah.
What was it like being on that? I guess that is a big deal in the international art world. What was it like to do a show on that stage?
It's a very big deal. It was a very controversial Biennale. I am still feeling the repercussions of it in some ways. But it was also very exciting, and I worked with a colleague, Italian colleague, Francesco Pizzopaolo, who was a marvelous help in trying to navigate the Italian part of the equation. Doing anything in Italy is difficult. The fact that they had Berlusconi for their prime minister tells you how difficult. And anything in Venice is difficult by Italian standards times two.
How was it controversial? What rose up that's still sticking with you to this day?
Well, I tried to actually do what a lot of curators talk about. I tried to make a truly international multimedia exhibition where the curator was not the subject, but the art was the subject, and where the differences among the works of art were also the subject. And that really grated with a lot of colleagues who see themselves as kind of super producers of exhibitions, with the artists and the art being basically cast members.
And I had thought when I saw you did that, well, however hard it might have been, at least you're in Venice, but do you really get to appreciate a city when you're doing this big, high-profile project?
Well, I took my wife and our two daughters, and they had a great time. I had a good time, but I didn't have a great time because I was working too hard. But it's a wonderful city, and now when I go to it, I feel kind of a pride of citizenship almost.
And another premier art place, the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Talk about working in that venue.
Well, I worked there altogether on staff for 12 years, and then I worked for another 3 years after that to produce my last exhibition. And I had a wonderful time for most of that time. And I have many, many friends among the trustees, among staff members, and so on to this day. I did not get along with the director and ultimately realized that it was a no-win situation, so I left. But it's an amazing institution with all its flaws, and it will continue to be one.
And you've done art in American embassies. Can you talk about bringing artwork outside of the traditional galleries and museums?
Well, American embassies are a place where an awful lot of the world that doesn't actually come to our shores meets America. And the whole history of art in public buildings, particularly government buildings, is a very problematic one, and none of the artists I work with want to have their art be used as cultural propaganda or as being symbolic of a particular political message. I think many of them actually kind of dissent from a good deal of what the United States has done in recent years. But it's important that their work be known. And in the same way that people would read the novels of Kurt Vonnegut or any number of writers who have been very challenging to America's image of itself, the art of America is like that. And it's good that it be in a place like that, and that people, when they come to do their business with the country, also see that we have a sense of humor about ourselves, also see that we disagree amongst ourselves, also see that we are of many colors and many cultures.
And speaking of culture, I think there's often an idea that in America, culture has to be culture, with a British accent, maybe a better one than I just delivered. Do we reach too much across the Atlantic for our ideas of high culture? Do we have enough of a uniquely American sense of our culture?
Well, I would say yes, but in the following specific way. I think we should talk no longer about the United States as being America, but the United States as being one of the Americas in the plural. And I think that from Tierra del Fuego to Baffin Bay, all of the countries with their different languages and their different ethnic mixes and so on and so forth belong to the post-colonial history of the great empires of Europe. And how each one of those countries has dealt with that legacy, how each one of these countries has produced its own modernist art, is really, really interesting. So rather than seeing the United States as an isolated case, we should see the entire hemisphere as being a zone of cultural invention and of cultural conflict, and that all of it is interesting. And sometimes the best way to understand what was done in New York is to look at what was done in Sao Paulo or in Caracas or someplace else.
How do you play with that in an exhibit setting?
Oh, that's one of the things I did in Venice. That's one of the things I've done here. I mean, I recently invited Jack Lerner, who's a Brazilian artist, to come and live at Yale and make work with students, and she created an entire exhibition while at Yale. And her way of dealing with now I will get into the cultural jargon, but the ready-made and the Duchampian kind of idea of art making is very different than what North Americans think of that. So to have a Brazilian tap into the same source but come up with something radically different was very useful.
Your talk in Madison is on Mr. and Ms. Inside Outside. In a nutshell, what kind of topics are you tackling there?
What I'm trying to address is the fact that often the world views, again, the culture a little bit, as you said, is the them and us situation. There's this cultural lead and there's everybody else. And then beyond that, there's this view as within that cultural lead, there are the power players in institutions and everybody else. But many of the most progressive, most imaginative, most risk-taking people in the art world actually work for museums, and they get very little credit for it. And they are often the best allies that artists have in terms of getting their work understood, seen, et cetera. So I want to talk a little bit about the fact that it's not a battle between the establishment and the avant-garde. It's a struggle that people in every possible position in the art world have in common if they really care about art more than money or prestige or all those other things.
We're talking to curator extraordinaire Robert Storr. In a few minutes, I'll ask him to talk about some of the artists he's written about over the years. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue the conversation with art critic and curator Robert Storr of Yale University. Robert, I wanted to ask you about some of the artists you've written about. You mentioned Jackson Pollock earlier. It's a name a lot of us are familiar with. There's been a movie. His art's pretty well known. Why was he such a significant figure in 20th century American art?
Well, he was the one member of a large group of painters who sort of came to the fore in the late 30s, early 40s. The one member who made the most radically different paintings in terms of what modern art had looked up until that time. There's a famous quote of his where he said, you know, well, Picasso's the man to beat. But he's really the one who not only challenged Picasso directly, but made something that Picasso had never anticipated. And that was a kind of painting in which there was no central image, but where activity and vitality was spread out over the entire surface so that you would look at a small painting or a huge painting and get the same discharge of energy everywhere and in very intense doses. This was very radical, and other artists eventually came around to doing this, but Pollock was the sort of the one who really blew it out.
Was there a negative reaction at the time because this was so different?
Enormous negative reaction. He barely ever sold a painting in his life outside of a very small circle of supporters. He never really made very much money. By today's standards, he made nothing. So that he was notorious, but he was also, unrewarded. And he's one of the last members of the old avant-garde, the kind of Garrett artist who suffers and dies and, you know, becomes famous posthumously.
That isn't so much the story anymore?
No, I mean, actually, it was never entirely the story.
Okay.
Rubens and Velázquez were famous and rich in their own day. So the idea of the Garrett artist is really a 19th century phenomenon. But there was a time when it was more true than not for many of the important artists, and Pollock was one example.
Another artist, a name I'm familiar with, and I've got to say I'm not as familiar with his work, Gerhard Richter.
Okay, Gerhard Richter is, from my point of view, one of the most important painters of the post-1945 era. And the 1945 marker is important because Gerhard was born in Nazi Germany. Actually, he was born just as Nazi Germany was becoming Nazi Germany. He lived through the war. He then had his youth in East Germany under the communist Stalinist regime and came to West Germany and to Western culture in 1961, moments before the Berlin Wall went up. And he had a second life after that. And in his own life, and that's a case where the life story does matter, mm-hmm. In his own life, he's had to resolve all these conflicts. What's it like to have a Nazi for an uncle? Actually, what's it like to have a major war criminal for a father-in-law, which he did? What's it like to have grown up making Stalinist pictures and then abandon that and also the rewards that went with it and to begin again as an unknown artist making work that at the very beginning he didn't even like that much, but he knew he had to make? So he's a story of adaptation, survival, learning, and then he has made some just drop-dead paintings that have changed the way we think about the art form.
How so?
One of the things he's done is he's given himself the permission to mix and match, so to speak. So he will make all over abstract paintings which are not like Pollock, but take on some of the same issues. And then in the same afternoon, he will work on a painting which will look like Vermeer. And he sort of has dissolved this battle between figuration and abstraction, between the seemingly, you know, sort of urgent emotional making of a picture and the patient fine crafting of a picture. He's dissolved those distinctions by showing that they're actually alternating currents in individuals and in the history of art.
So you're talking about how he was wrestling with the same issues probably all of Germany was, the post-Nazi era, the Berlin Wall era, eventually reunification. Do you think that he means something different to a German than to the rest of us looking in from the outside?
I think he does somewhat, and I'll tell you one other piece of the puzzle. In 1995, I went to Germany to see him for the first time, actually, and to negotiate the acquisition by MoMA of a group of paintings called the October Cycle. And it's October 18th, 1977, is the date of the paintings and the title of the paintings. And they're about a group called the Baader-Meinhof Group, which was a group of left-wing student political people who became actual terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
And I acquired these paintings because I thought they were amazing paintings. But they addressed a situation which was in some way specifically German. And the story of this group and what it did is very much bound up in this post-war history and war guilt and so on. At the same time, we had the Weather Underground. We had the Black Panthers. We had the Symbionese Liberation Army. We had a whole lot of similar groups in this country. And no one in this country has ever tackled them in a serious way in pictorial art. And so I thought this would be interesting to have this work because it's such great painting, and there are reasons for that. But also, it would be interesting to see how Americans work through their own traumatic experience by considering that of someone in another culture.
It's amazing to think about how art, you think of something as so intensely personal and in a place and a time, and yet so often leaping beyond those bounds and becoming something of universal interest and appreciation.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Robert Redford's just made a film on the Weather Underground or something very similar to it, right? So this is really part of our experience, and Richter has from his side. And mind you, Richter was an anti-communist who had fled East Germany, who had no kind of romantic feelings about revolution whatsoever. And what his interest was in how idealistic people could start out doing the right thing and end up doing the wrong thing. That was the subject of these paintings. Mm-hmm. And that's something that we in this country would do well to consider.
Another artist I wanted to talk about, Louise Bourgeois, you've written about.
Yeah, a great deal. I knew her for 30 years. I knew her before she got really famous. I knew her after she got really famous. And she lived until she was 90, almost 98. And she's an amazing artist because this is somebody who grew up when modern art was new. She went to school and studied with Leger, the French Cubist painter. She was friendly with the Surrealists because they have their gallery in the building where she had an apartment. She came to New York, and she knew Jackson Pollock. She knew Mark Rothko. She knew all these people. But she was a woman, and being a woman in that context was really tough. And she was determined to become an artist in her own way, and she did. But it took her years and years and years to, one, get the confidence to do what she needed to do, and two, it took her even more years till her 80s to get the attention that she deserved. So it's about the long slog that many women have had, and Joan Mitchell's another, and the list goes on, get for women the kind of regard and consideration that male artists have had for many years.
When she found that confidence, as you mentioned, what did she bring to the art world? What was her influence then?
Profound. I mean, and one of the reasons that she was so important was that she was doing things that younger artists were doing, but doing them in even more radical ways, and often doing them before the younger artists started, so that when younger artists came up with these ideas, they looked to her as a role model. So in 1966, for example, the great curator and critic Lucie Depard did an exhibition called Eccentric Abstraction, which was one of the first major appearances of Eva Hesse and Bruce Nauman. And Louise, who was 20 or 30 years older than them, was in that exhibition. In the 1990s and late 80s, when neo-expressionism and neo-symbolism came along, Louise was in those exhibitions because she was fresh. It was new work she was showing. So the idea that one has this kind of nice sort of parabolic rise and fall in a career is nuts. You know, artists who are really determined have very erratic attention. They have very erratic work, But the long-lived artists of that kind do amazing things all their lives.
I had more artists I was going to ask about, but we're a little short on time. And I wanted to ask you, is there an artist or two today who are not famous yet that you're keeping an eye on and would suggest we check out?
I'm always keeping an eye on artists, mm-hmm. and there are many of them. One who is pretty famous but not well-known in this country is Raymond Pettibone, who I think is an extraordinary artist. Another is Jack Lerner, who's from Brazil. I mean, there are many artists that I have put in my exhibitions and written about, and the reason I write about a lot of them is because I don't think it's ever been a matter of the one or two top people. Mm. It's always been a kind of delta of artists moving at different speeds and doing different things, but all interconnected.
That was Robert Storr, curator, art critic, and dean of the Yale School of Art.